Welcome to Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast, which nearly took the day off sick, but didn't want to annoy the Prime Minister any more than it already has. I'm Jacob Jarvis. On today's show, Sunak's got a message to the nation. Don't worry, be happy. He's taking on what he deems a culture of sick notes, which is stopping the nation from being productive enough. He's also suggesting people should buck up and deal better with mental health issues, which is pretty rich coming from someone who has been so damaging to our collective mental well-being. Then Keir Starmer looks like he's going to be the next Prime Minister, whenever an election finally happens, as he rides high in the polls. But that might not translate into instant popularity. How might he handle the prospect of being disliked pretty quickly by a large chunk of the electorate? Now, let's meet today's panel. First up is columnist and reporter specialising in social affairs, Hannah Fearn. Hi, Hannah.
Hello.
So the Mark Menzies or Mingus drama, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his last name, so I'm covering myself there, has resulted in him leaving the Tory party, but he will remain an MP until the next election. Surely we need to reform this being able to happen. And does it also sort of this kind of parliamentary limbo just leave everyone in a very confusing place?
So misconduct in public office, which I guess is the thing that we'd start pursuing him over, is a really, really ill-defined offence. And of course, innocent until proven guilty and so on. But for sitting MPs, I think this shows that the parties just have far too much power. We are paying through public funds the salaries of these MPs. So the fact that the party can control what occurs in terms of the internal investigation, whether or not he stays until the next election, seems to me the area that does need reform. His former comms director was one of the people who raised concerns about his behaviour and the allegations against him. And she described being dismissed by the Tories as an old woman. Basically, they were ignoring, because she's in her, I think, 80s now. She's like much older and been involved with the party for over 50 years. Yeah. And they just weren't listening. How can it be that also that the Tories have apparently failed to interview the original whistleblowers before concluding their internal investigation? So that doesn't sound like a complete investigation to me. And we can't see a copy of that internal investigation, despite the fact that we're all paying his salary collectively. So I think there ought to be some kind of open and transparent process that is not run by the party structure. It's somebody who's a sitting MP.
We also have, joining us today, columnist and Papercuts regular and author of the brand new A History of the World in 47 Borders, which is out now in all good bookshops. It's John Elledge. Hi, John.
Hello.
So, John, the Rwanda bill is back in the Commons at the moment, and there are MPs sitting as we speak, so we don't know exactly what the state of play will be while you're listening to this. But as the government pushes for it to go through, Deputy Foreign Secretary Andrew Mitchell said that Kigali is safer than London, which is great news, I suppose. And meanwhile, Sunak has said flights are booked and ready to go. Regardless of how all of this goes, at this point, you know, when they're having to suggest, well, you know, Kigali's safe, it's safer than London, has this just all been a very clear example of Sunak being simply terrible at politics?
Yeah, I mean, the only hesitation I have with agreeing with the premise of the question is quite how many other examples we've had. Yeah. I mean, I did enjoy his period of briefing friendly newspapers that if we didn't stop being so mean to him, he'd quit and go back to California. There was also the bit where he went to Manchester to cancel the new railway line to Manchester and seemed to expect to get applause for this. But the incredible thing about the Rwanda thing is how much political capital he is chucking at this thing that's not even popular. Like, if you kind of look at the polling of this policy, YouGov's got a lot of numbers. Only 28% of the electorate think it'll be very or fairly effective, compared to 53% who think it'll be not very or not at all. Only 18% think it's good value for money, and I would quite like to speak to that 18%. Only 14% think it's likely to work, compared to 66% who think it isn't. This is just like, nobody wants this thing.
No.
Like, the polling gets slightly better if you drill down into, like, you know, Tory voters or Leave voters or whatever it is. But he is nonetheless wasting an enormous amount of political capital, not to mention actual capital, on this policy that nobody actually wants and nobody thinks it's going to work. And he's doing this at a point when he's, you know, 20 points behind in the polls and needs to win people over. It's baffling.
So finally, we have Guardian columnist and author of Politics, A Survivor's Guide, Raf Baer, with us. Hello, Raf.
Hi there.
Raf, so since we last recorded, there have been exchanges of missile strikes between Iran and Israel. What do you make of the current state of this conflict? And how do you see Britain and other European nations responding to all of this going forward?
I mean, it's very hard to find any upside in what's going on in the Middle East at the moment. But actually, I think there is a way of configuring where we are now to, you know, at least pull the lever back from despair a little bit, because actually, you know, for a very long time, obviously, Israel and Iran have been the two big antagonistic powers in that region, just in militarily there. Well, I suppose, and with Saudi Arabia in the mix as well. So, but, you know, very antagonistic in a kind of combination of Cold War, proxy war. So for that to have been upgraded into a direct confrontation, you know, so for Iran to sort of unleash from Iranian territory more ordnance onto Israel than Russia heaped onto Ukraine in the first days of that invasion, was a really significant change in the character of that confrontation. And, you know, it would have been entirely plausible within character of the Netanyahu government for the response to be equivalently vast, and therefore we would start spiraling towards the drain of a really terrible, catastrophic situation. One, you know, Israel actually has nuclear weapons. Iran has become close to getting them. It could have gone very badly wrong. And the fact that actually the Israeli response was tactical and sort of focused in a way to send a signal along the lines of, we could do you a lot more harm than this if we wanted to, but we're choosing not to.
Actually, it felt more like posturing from my perception.
The sense, and then if Iran responding to that in actually a very subdued way, saying, well, you know, these things happen, let's all, you know, nothing to see here, move along now. And I can't speculate about what kind of diplomacy went on behind the scenes there, but at least some rational action went on here.
Yeah.
These were states behaving like rational actors, recognizing what was at stake. And that in and of itself, actually, frankly, I find a little bit encouraging. So I think it's not the worst thing that's happened in the Middle East in the last, you know, few months.
Last Friday, the front page of The Express, which according to Wikipedia is some sort of right-wing pamphlet for elderly Brexit supporters that was once upon a time a newspaper, bellowed, PM tells Sick Note Britain, get a grip and get a job. Sunak wants to trial having work and health professionals issue fit notes, shifting away from GPs carrying out this role. I'm not sure if that means he no longer considers GPs to be health professionals, but I wouldn't put it past him when it comes to insulting people as he does. Raf, can you give me a quick outline of what Sunak said and what's actually new within it?
Well, the essence of it, as you've just described, is the proposition that if too many people are not working who could be deemed fit to work, the diagnosis of why that's happening is essentially they're going to their GPs, they're complaining about stress and anxiety, that the GPs are, for whatever reason, doling out fit notes, or what more commonly called sick notes, like Smarties. And as a result, those people aren't in the labour market. And that can be configured as an economic problem because you want your healthy labour force to be working. And also a kind of a cultural gripe, a sort of complaint, which is familiar going back generations, really, where people of a certain age look at people who aren't working and think they basically need a kick up the backside instead of engaging with whatever treatment they might actually want for their stress and anxiety or whatever else it is that might be keeping them out of the labor market. So the headline policy response is have some other mechanism to evaluate whether these people are or aren't fit to work. And further down the line, if it turns out they are fit to work and they're still not working, you cut their benefits again. Yeah. So the template as a policy instrument is incredibly familiar. We've been around this many times before. I mean, at the base of it is a genuine social and economic issue, which is that the UK has quite an extraordinarily high number of people, but relative to similar countries, relative to G7 countries, relative to the rest of Europe, of people who are in the part of the population that would normally be in the labour market not working. So by some measures, sort of one in five, and that's an awful lot of people. And then separately, there is also an issue. Most health professionals, doctors will confirm that it is true that a lot of people are presenting with symptoms of the various combination of mental health problems and are being signed off work. Now, the problem with saying the issue there is there's nothing wrong with them, they need to kick up the backside, is there's very often something wrong with them, and what they would like is treatment and or more thorough diagnosis. And the idea that some outsourced algorithm robot sort of Chris Grayling style policy box that's going to spit out a little slip saying, actually, you're fine, get off your backside and go to work, is self-evidently not going to address the problems that these people in the labour market have.
Yeah, Rishi Sunak's going to be working with Elon Musk to create some sort of AI to do this, I imagine.
Yeah.
Do you think they actually believe this, though. That's the, because I think we sometimes give them this credit that things they are doing are tactical in the way you're saying, and it's to pitch these people. But if there also may be just some point that Rishi Sunak and some of this brand of the Tory party just genuinely believe the sort of comic book style scrounger narrative they've tried to create for themselves, which...
Yeah, I think crudely speaking, yes. I mean, I do think, well, there are two things. First of all, yeah, they believe that there is a problem with the inactivity in the labour market, because there is. So they're absolutely right to identify the problem that there are people who notionally would probably pass some test of fitness to be able to work. But they're not necessarily the people who are turning up to the GP complaining about stress and anxiety or having mental health problems. That's actually two separate issues that have been conflated. And then in terms of the diagnosis, the sort of lazy cultural diagnosis of there's nothing wrong with these people. First of all, if you are Rishi Sunak, you're not necessarily steeped in a lot of the data and information. A lot of his views, I mean, very bluntly speaking, do seem to have just been gleaned from the leader column of The Spectator going back a few years. I mean, I've never heard him really come up with a cultural or economic or political analysis that wasn't sort of skimmed off the top of The Spectator, ultimately. And that's why he was a Eurosceptic. That's why he was a Leaver back in 2016. Yeah. He actually had a very shallow understanding of these things. I mean, just to illustrate the point, this is someone who, in this wider context of benefits policy, said... And this is talking about retaining the cap, the way you have a 2-child per family cap on your benefit entitlements. That was a very convoluted way of saying that. But he basically said, you know, you don't get any more money when you have more children. And unfortunately, that's only true if you've forgotten about child benefit. Yeah. And which, or you don't realize that actually child benefit is something that gets means tested. So obviously no one he knows gets child benefits because they're all earning more than £80,000 per year.
Yeah.
So just there is a kind of lazy ignorance born of never actually hanging out with anyone who's actually used the benefit system that I think feeds into this at quite a profound level.
And on the mental health side of things as well, I suppose if everyone you know is capable of being able to afford private therapy and private care and that kind of thing, then the situation just can't present as it is to the general population.
And the idea that maybe, yes, you're presenting to your GP what you're saying you're experiencing is anxiety and stress, that that might also have comorbidities with all sorts of very, very serious illness. So people who are extremely ill, definitely can't work, can also be anxious and depressed about their illness. So it's so vacuous as an analysis of what might be going on here. It's sort of painful and would be funny if it wasn't tragic.
Hannah, what is the reality then around the sort of state of long-term sickness in this country?
I mean, Raph's right that the number of people who say they are inactive due to long-term sickness, which, by the way, isn't, as he said, the number of people who are claiming sick notes, because they're very different things, but it is really high. It's 2.8 million, and that is an increase of more than 200,000 in 1 year and 700,000 since the pandemic started. So, but that, what's going on there? There's two things. The pandemic destroyed the NHS, long waiting lists to get treatment for all kinds of routine things that can actually destroy your day-to-day ability to operate well and to get out and, you know, whether it's like, you know, surgery you need or even if it's mental health support. Secondly, obviously the pandemic created mental health problems. We know that. We know that the lockdowns, whatever your view on whether they were a successful virus control policy at the time and prevented many deaths, which I think broadly I agree with, they did have a huge, significant impact on mental health, particularly for young people who are now coming into their early 20s or teens at the time. So, of course, it's going to have an impact. We need to just grapple with that rather than pretend it doesn't exist. But also, there's a problem on the stats here around that 2.8 million, because it also includes a lot of people who aren't claiming sick notes, who are over 50, who have chosen to retire early because they don't feel well enough to work themselves. Their doctor might have not signed them off. They might not have this official diagnosis that Sunak's looking for. But they say, look, I'm 56 now. I don't feel well. I have a pension. I'm just not going to work. Another thing that's really interesting about this sick note idea is that the data that has been gathered about GP practice issuing these notices suggests that the numbers that are being issued are actually completely flat since 2019. So all of those stats that I've just discussed is irrelevant to the number of sick or fit notices being issued. They're two separate things entirely.
Also, I would just add to that, if you're a GP and you know that there's no possible available referral because there isn't the provision, you can't refer someone to, you know, see a mental health nurse or get therapies or any treatments because the care isn't there, by default, the least you can do is basically sign that person off work for a period. So, right. I mean, again, so it's the underlying problem of there not being sufficient NHS care for people is, again, not something that the Prime Minister felt the need to address.
GPs have a duty of care in a way Tory Prime Ministers do not.
Prime Ministers, you'd like to think have some kind of duty of care. But yes, I accept your point.
One thing that I think is allied to Raf's point about Sunak having no understanding of what it is to work in the formal economy, as most people do, is that you can be dismissed after 28 days for being long-term sick, because on the basis of capacity, it's legal to start a dismissal process on the basis that somebody no longer has the capacity to work after 28 days. So when he's talking about long-term sick, is that what he's talking about? Because he's making it sound like people are on 3 years sick claiming constant benefits or employer support, when actually we could be just literally talking about a month, and the waiting lists are well over a month.
The killer phrase was lifestyle choice. As soon as he says some people are basically claiming benefits as a lifestyle choice, then that you have reached for the laziest tropes, cliches of a set of arguments that have been churning round and round on this issue to bring down the benefits budget, since before George Osborne had even thought that that might be a fun thing to do.
I just think more thought is going into the causes and the numbers here in this room in the last 20 minutes than has anywhere in the government before it put out this policy.
And we've literally only started the conversation.
Yeah,
we're also keeping track more of things that, say, Rishi Sunak has said, for example, because on going back to the COVID point, which I know a lot does link back to at the moment, but they constantly talked about us all having to make sacrifices, and now they seem to be not reckoning with the fact that sacrifices naturally have consequences, which could be issues with people's mental health. And how can you square those two things up with what he was saying during the as at that height of the pandemic and now?
Doesn't I find really make that any sense. Personally the most morally sort of depressing point.
Yeah.
Especially, I recently wrote a piece for The Observer about some new research that demonstrated how significant the impact on the mental health of teenage boys lockdown had been, much more than girls. And, you've got to grapple with it. We can't just start shouting at people and claiming that they're lazy.
On the assessment side of things, Hannah, I feel like we've just tried that before and it didn't go particularly well. Is my memory failing me?
No, you're absolutely right. So the DWP outsourced assessment of personal independence payment, which is a benefit for working age people who have long-term conditions or disabilities, and also work capability assessments to organisations like Atos and Capita and so on. And it was basically a disaster. The latest Ministry of Justice figures from tribunal hearings, this is specifically for PIP, personal independence payment claims, found that 70% of the DWP's initial decisions were overturned in favour of the claimant between 2018 and 2023. So they were just routinely getting it wrong. So, they overhauled the system. They brought a lot of it back in-house. Atos have been wiped out. They haven't won a single contract for the next round, which starts this year.
Good.
Great. But it sounds like they're about to rebuild the same process.
Yeah.
It's like, we literally just did this under the same administration with the same journalists covering it, watching this. Do you think we'd not know?
That is the thing. This is my first thought when I saw that announcement. I bet they'll claim its AI is involved somewhere and therefore it's all incredibly sophisticated. Yeah. It is extraordinary how sort of it's like the worst sequel of the worst franchise of a film that
Absolutely.
You just don't want to be in anymore.
For a second, I thought you meant that AI was generating Tory policy at this point.
They'd probably do a better job, to be honest.
Their lack of understanding as well of how precarious people are, and that they will suggest there is an appeals process to this, but you have to be in a privileged position to be able to go through that amount of time and take that and not be fallen into a really horrible circumstance. A lot of people can't push back.
It does feel a lot like, this Conservative government on and off, if you throw in Lib Dem bit as well, has been in power for 14 years. They've tried more or less every iteration of Conservative ideology, policy making. They've done Brexit. They're really, it's like watching someone thinking, well, when we used to push this button, this light would go on. And we've done the sort of, crackdown on immigration button, keep pressing jab in that. No light, not going on. And there's the cracking down on benefits button. Yeah. And it feels as if there is just now, it's almost kind of robotic, automatic in terms of the narrowness of what is available, what levers they think they might have to generate some kind of political momentum. And it's, I think we've probably already sufficiently overthought this in this room, as you say, more than they have.
I only think that the only thing I can feel positive about this is that I don't think it will ever happen because we are going to have a Labour government. So something will happen around managing access to the economy and employment and the balance with people saying they have long-term sick needs, but it isn't going to be this, thankfully.
John, mental health is, you know, the big target around this. And it does seem like they've removed any sense of individual kind of perspective from this equation. So Sunak did say we should see it as a sign of progress that people can talk openly about mental health conditions in a way that only a few years ago was unthinkable. And he said he'll never dismiss or downplay the illnesses people have, but then goes on to say, but our overall approach is about saying that people with less severe mental health conditions should be expected to engage with the world of work. Have they detailed in any remote way, shape or form what exactly will be their barrier of severe enough? Or is it just...
I mean, no, of course not. No. But I mean, like, as Hammer said, this isn't... They're not expecting to implement this. This is about the headlines. It's not actually about getting people back into work. It's about taking on the form of policy, but not the function of it. I mean, I find that quote, I will never dismiss or downplay the illnesses people have, sort of incredible under the circumstances, partly because that is literally what he is doing here. That is the purpose of the statement, is to say you people aren't sick. But also, like, even if he means that, I don't think he does, but even if he did, it is not the Prime Minister whose job it is going to be to kind of look again at, you know, whether these people are actually severe. It's going to be some underpaid worker in a call centre working for Serco or
Capita. With a flowchart.
Yeah, and a Target. They're going to have, like, you know, they will be expected to reject 67% of people or something. That's how it's going to work. And we have seen how stuff like this works. Because, like, this is how, as you said, this is how they dealt with, like, welfare stuff in the past. This is how the Home Office deals with immigration claims. It's like, you just end up with these incredibly heartless policies. Because, like, even if the people who came up with them had the best of intentions, which I don't think they did, you know, that is how it's going to work in practice. And the other thing I keep thinking is, like, you can't actually separate mental health from physical health, from quality of life, from poverty. Like, you know, the doctor's acronym, SLS, shit life syndrome. Yeah. It's like, well, this person is clearly ill because everything is just rubbish.
Yeah.
And like, it is not entirely on the health service to be able to fix all these problems that have been generated by 14 years of terrible government and economic crisis and so on. Yeah. But I just don't think you can kind of shout people into feeling better.
No, certainly not. I mean, you just can't also, in terms of the ranking of mental health conditions, I find particularly crass, because my not particularly severe mental health crisis might be someone else's severe mental health crisis for how they feel. We're all, people are individuals, which they don't seem to want to consider in any way, shape or form here, really. You know, is it them just ditching all kinds of responsibility as well? This is just them trying to push away completely from any idea that they are, as you say, responsible more widely for society, and saying, no, this, it's like they're saying mental health is in your head. Which obviously in certain ways, yes, it's a mental health, but that's based around the things around you, which they have some control over.
Yeah. I mean, if I was being deeply cynical about the sort of philosophical basis of modern Toryism, I'd point out that, like, they do have form for this of just, like, blaming structural forces on individual weakness. Like, if you kind of think back to the famous Norman Tebbit quote from the 80s telling people to get on their bike to look for work, that was the same thing. Like, there were structural reasons in many parts of the country there weren't enough jobs to go around at that point, which were not unconnected from the policies being implemented by the government in which he was a cabinet minister. But he transferred that to blaming the individual for not trying hard enough. And this is a regular theme of a lot of Tory policymaking.
It's an interesting comparison there, because actually, you know, one of the things that's fascinating about the underlying issue that's not being addressed here, that's sort of being glanced off in relation to this, is that actually for a long time, certainly for our generation, I think because of the experience of the early 80s and the mass unemployment and 3 million being this totemic number, sort of the definition of a really sick economy was actually unemployment. And that was the point at which you really felt that, you know, that was the millstone that hung around the neck of a failing government. And actually, after everything that's happened, even, you know, actually through austerity, one of the reasons Ed Balls didn't get a lot of as much political traction as he might have done in criticizing George Osborne's economic policy was actually unemployment didn't go up that much. The employment level has stayed actually surprisingly healthy through a really, really underperforming UK economy. And actually what's interesting, you know, separate from the question of footnotes and who's stress and anxiety and various other mental health conditions, this question of 20% of people who, for whatever reason, are not participating in the labour market and how that is a symptom of just the difficulty the UK economy collectively has being productive and growing is only starting to register now. And again, it's just coming back to your point, Jacob, that the Conservative Party, this is on them. They've been governing now for long enough that if there is a really deep systemic structural reason why the country just isn't working, literally isn't working, like, whose fault is that? It's too big and everyone can see it. And that's why they're losing. Yeah. That is the big picture why there's nothing more they can say.
Did you read that piece by the economics writer, Chris Dillow, a few weeks ago, basically saying, like, possibly one of the problems with the economy is that we haven't destroyed enough jobs, that, like, actually maybe full employment has kind of contributed to the productivity puzzle.
Because we've got zombie jobs in the way that you once had sort of zombie firms.
Bullshit jobs as well.
Yeah.
So, you know.
If you can just, like, hire someone for a crappy salary, you don't necessarily invest in the capex and the plant to do things more effectively and raise productivity. Mm. So, like, it's all potentially connected.
I mean, as we were just saying, there are other issues as well. And one of them is childcare. Childcare is so expensive. You end up pushing mostly women, sometimes men, but in families where there are two parents and you're looking at how you divvy up, you know, what we're going to spend and what we're saving by somebody not being in the workplace. It's phenomenal. After school clubs are exactly the same. I know so many people who are not working 40 or 50 hours a week when they could and maybe want to because they simply cannot find anyone to pick up their kids or look after them.
And this is another good example of way in which the Conservative Party has just hit an ideological dead end, because that was broadly the argument that the Chancellor was making when they did their recent childcare thing, which was sort of slightly underfunded and half-baked. But they're still basically, we're at least saying, look, we need people, mostly women, to be able to go back to work when they have young children. So we're making these nursery places available. And there are a significant number of Conservatives going, but actually, isn't what we really want is for women to be staying at home and being good Conservative families. And they couldn't really articulate what it was they actually were thinking about this, because although they knew there was sort of a problem and they knew that people were unhappy because they couldn't afford childcare, when they tried to think through what is the social and economic outcome we're really after from this, they didn't know and they couldn't agree.
And yet, weirdly, all they needed to come up with was the word choice, which fundamentally is supposed to be a Conservative thing, that everybody has the independence to run their lives in the way they want. So it's just mad that we can sit here and think of that and they don't seem to have been able to.
But the problem from social Conservative point of view is that some people would choose wrong.
But is it also that this seems like a party that has completely forgot any kind of importance of process whatsoever. It's almost like, saying things are interconnected here, but the Brexit mindset of things will simply be good if we wish them so and say it will be good. All of these problems we spoke about here, they're addressing problems. They're addressing things which are tangible and real and need fixing. But that would be like me saying, I want to be a Premier League footballer, but I'm never going to exercise. I'm never going to go run. I'm never going to do any of that. But that's something I need to do. But I'm not going to do anything that will actually get me there. I'm just going to say, I want to get there. Do they feel like the Tories have kind of done that with the process?
Well, I think there's two elements to that. I mean, certainly Brexit, I think, because it was, I mean, a terrible idea generally, I think, but also never going to deliver the outcomes that were promised by the method that was promised. Leaving the EU wasn't going to give people what they thought they were going to get from leaving the EU. That baked in very hard the ethos, exactly as you're describing. And also now they're just out of time. So the Rwanda bill is another great example. It's like, even if in all good faith, they sincerely thought the best way to deter people from crossing the channel illegally was the scheme they've got in place, there aren't enough places in Kigali. You know, it's none of it works. None of it adds up. So at every stage in the process, it comes down to, you know, what's the headline? Can we claim it is being done? Can we say it has been done? Can we move on to the next thing? And they're out of time.
Thank you. Next up, it's time to choose our hero and villain of the week. Who's hot and who's not this week? So, John, starting with you, who is your hero and who is your, on the other side, villain?
Okay, well, as hero, I'm going the person who more than anybody else, I think, is making the case for a Labour government. It's Liz Truss, who's been absolutely magnificent this week. I mean, like, she's just been going around. Every time anyone's put a microphone in front of her, she's come up with a whole different group of people she blames for her own miserable failure. There is something genuinely inspirational about the level of self-confidence on show from a woman who faced the most devastating, humiliating levels of professional failure, and she's just not letting it get her down. And she is really, really making the case for a change of government. She is doing more than anyone else to firm up Labour's poll lead, I think.
So if Liz Truss is your hero, who possibly is your villain? I'd like to know.
I'm going a bit more obscure here. I'm going to go for the chair of the New Ferry Residents Association on the Wirral.
Okay.
So in 2017, an explosion on the Wirral destroyed 60 homes. It left 78 people homeless. Destroyed a number of businesses. Somebody went to jail for this. But the chair of the aforementioned Residents Association went on the record to the Liverpool Echo last week saying, if a proposal to build 43 homes on a car park in the town centre goes ahead, this will be a bigger disaster for local businesses than the explosion in 2017 because their customers will have nowhere to park.
Amazing.
That, I mean, that is just like the purest demonstration of NIMBY philosophy, I think.
Yeah, that's that is quite something. Hannah, what are yours?
Okay, so my hero is Caroline Lucas. She's given an interview to John Harris in The Guardian about leaving Parliament this week, and she's got a book out called Another England, How to Reclaim Our National Story. In that feature with John, she gave this brilliant quote where she just said, I've been the Green Party's front bench spokesperson on absolutely everything for 14 years and it is exhausting. And I just think, you know, I don't agree with everything that she says in terms of policy platform, but I think she's been an absolutely inspirational MP. Yeah. She's really contributed to our public life. It's just, I'm sad to see her leaving, and I just think, yeah, she deserves my hero vote this week.
So who's the villain?
My villain, this is a bit silly, is Jamie Oliver. He's got a new TV show out about air fryers, and I'm so sick of TV shows that just make people buy shit they don't need, and I feel like this is the latest iteration of it.
So you definitely don't need an air fryer. I'm really confident about that.
I know. I'm not getting one. I'm in the anti-air fryer league.
I've been looking at 2-drawer air fryers over the weekend, so I'll leave myself there.
You can use the second, the spare drawer on that one. So you definitely even more don't need one now.
Just use a hairdryer. I don't understand the difference.
Raph, who are yours?
Hero, I'm going to go for the 78-year-old Conservative campaign in Mark Menzies-Mingus' seat, who got the call in the middle of the night saying, I'm in a flat with some bad people and I need £5,000.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Well, yeah, this is reported to have said, to have been said. And I know nothing about this person's politics. I'm confident I would disagree with a lot of it and or really about this person at all. But just this, it conjured up this image of these people who are so important to politics and so unsung.
And this is the woman, I got the age wrong, 78.
She might be older than that because I don't know when it happened. But
this is the woman who then, when she actually lent into her party for support, was told she was like basically an old woman, go away.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I just think, you know, parliamentary democracy in this country would not function without these people just giving so much of their time and energy and labour and not wanting to be the hero, not seeking the limelight, just doing it out of civic duty. And we'd be in a lot of trouble as a country politically without people doing those jobs. So that would be my hero. And villain, as you mentioned earlier on in the recording, Andrew Mitchell saying that Kigali is safer than London, as part of a defence of the Rwanda scheme. First of all, he was a serious development minister at one point. He understands the difference between policy that works and policy that's completely ridiculous. And also, just there's something weirdly, crassly stupid about the way Conservatives now just have given up on London as somewhere where there might be Conservatives. They're so prepared. They just think it's like, it's Sadiq Khan's evil, crime-infested, knife-wielding fiefdom that will never, not safe for anyone. It's the capital city of the country. At some stage, would it not just be sort of strategically astute to pretend you might like it or want to go there, and that it's not just some horrible, benighted, crime-infested megacity hellhole? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just had to roll my eyes a bit too hard for that. So he's my villain.
Luckily, our studio is very robust. So, I mean, you're showing your privilege of how safe you are in London right now because of that. I'm going to go, so let me look at this logic. Liz Truss just gets her own category, which is beyond the point of hero or villain. She's just a unique entity in some way there. So with that in mind, I'm going to pick Caroline Lucas as hero because, yeah, I think she's done plenty of good and been a strong, just a good MP and an example of what can be achieved there in that side. And then I'm going to go Andrew Mitchell as my villain of the week because it's just... You just don't have to say so much stupid shit. And I'd quite like them to stop. Jamie Oliver, fair play on the air fryers, but he banned vending machines at school when I was there. So I've got, got a problem, though. In the polls, Starmer is miles ahead of Sunak on basically every measure, other than when pollsters ask, who do you think has the richest wife, which Sunak tends to win by a landslide. But unfortunately for Starmer, riding high in the polls might not mean he's an instantly popular prime minister. If he wins, everyone touch wood, please, how will he handle potentially being unpopular from the very off? And can he counter that? Or do some gaps in policy, or at least in narrative, mean that it's going to be a tough task? John, how popular is Starmer now? We know there have been points and we've seen those sort of word clouds where people don't really have very much of an opinion on him. But has that developed a little bit over time?
Well, you remember Beatlemania?
Yes. Well, no, actually. I wasn't alive.
That's fine because it's nothing like that. So actually, I was surprised. I looked at YouGov have a lot of trackers for this stuff. So I looked at their website. They do have Starmer as currently the country's most popular Labour politician. On 30% of people okay. surveyed like him, so it's quite a low bar. Gordon Brown's in third, Sadiq Khan fifth, Jeremy Corbyn is 17th, Tony Blair all the way down in 21st. But then I realised this doesn't actually do the sort of net thing of like taking off how many people hate them. This is just how many people say they like them.
Okay.
There are a couple of other trackers that are worth looking at. One I found quite interesting was, except for a brief period in the middle of 2021 when things are going at the worst for him, like that was we still had the vaccine bounce. It was before Partygate broke. Other than then, there have always been more people who think he should remain as Labour leader and stand down. He is more popular with Labour voters than the wider public, which is in some ways surprising given Labour's propensity for hating its own leaders, but probably not that surprising. The stat I find most concerning from Starmer's point of view is that, as things stand, more people say that he doesn't look like a prime minister in waiting than say that he does. Mm. It's 43% to 34%. Now, that's a narrower gap than before the polls kind of went nuts for Labour, but that's still very striking that if Labour can be 20 points ahead and people are still saying this guy doesn't look like a prime minister, I do wonder if that says something about a lack of gravitas.
Well, on that image side of things, there's clearly some sort of void around how people feel about him. It's the concern that then if he comes in a negative environment, as he's likely to, unless Sunak does something miraculous, but if he comes in and the country's not in a good state, that vacuum does just leave a lot of gap to be filled up with negative feeling, doesn't it?
I think that's true. I think that's obviously going to happen. I think... at the outside, 18 months into a new government, people are going to hate Starmer. But I also don't think it's that unusual. Like, his inheritance is pretty terrible. But if you think about basically every prime minister we've had has been pretty unpopular when they came into office. Theresa May wasn't that unpopular until people saw more of her when her ratings plummeted. The only one who people seemed to actively like until he was in office was Tony Blair, and that didn't end particularly well either. I think with both Blair and May, I think with both of them, like, it's striking that like both Blair and May were like the more popular ones at the start, and they kind of plummeted really quite far.
It's a bit unfair. May, she threw it away within a year, and Tony Blair governed for a decade and won three elections.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think basically as soon as anybody actually found out who May was, it collapsed. But people really liked all those front pages about how she was basically Thatcher.
Is that kind of a problem here, though, then, I suppose, that popularity among prime ministers is something we're even focusing on so much. You know, maybe would it not be good if politicians, I don't know if any of you agree with me on here, that we don't actually care about them being sort of cool and popular, perhaps, and that sort of maybe stemmed from the Tony Blair era somewhat.
Yeah, I think we certainly have this peculiar situation where we have a very presidential culture of politics, but constitutionally an extremely parliamentary system, as demonstrated by the fact that we've managed to change prime minister a number of times recently without having a general election. So actually, you know, it would be more sort of in tune with the constitutional arrangements we have if we cared less about the personality of the prime minister. I just think that it's sort of not reasonable in the current broader cultural climate that we live in to expect people to not to sort of, you know, people will look at the prime minister and leader and sort of want to draw general conclusions about the type of person they are. I mean, people are busy and they need a kind of shorthand for what vibes do I get from you? Would I like to have a pint with you? Are you a serious person? And actually, those judgments, they're not unreasonable. I think people do, you know, who was it? The American campaign who said a sort of an election campaign is like an MRI of your soul. People do get to know these leaders and they do form judgments about them. And I think, you know, what did for Boris Johnson is people worked out who he was, and he was a lying tow rag. And I think actually with Theresa May as well, people realized what she was actually like. And I think you're getting it now with Rishi Sunak. People get it. Actually, there's not that much there. He looks really professional and slick and serious, but actually it's quite shallow. He doesn't really know what he believes, and he doesn't really know what the point of himself even is in office. And he's been called out on that. So I think there's a certain amount of you know, you have to be realistic about how politics is going to work.
I kind of think it could go either way for Starmer, actually, because on the one level, I think, like, he's got a certain pooterish quality of, like, you know, you do constantly feel like he's about to start a sentence with why, oh, why, oh, why, a sort of exasperation that I think can play well in opposition, but isn't going to look so great when he's in charge. But on the other hand, I think he does have a certain seriousness to him.
There's definitely a depth. Like, he really does understand policy and care about it, and went into politics after having a very successful career in another discipline entirely, much longer than many other people before they go into politics. So I do feel like that, if that element comes through after the years of Johnson and Sunak, that's going to feel weighty. Yeah.
But the last prime minister I think we had who seemed like that was Gordon Brown, and that didn't play that well then, did it?
Yeah, I mean, to his credit, I think, you know, something thing I've been quite impressed by, because I was quite wary to begin with. You know, he's built this plane while flying it. I mean, he came into politics without that much experience of it. He had to make a lot of really difficult decisions within the Labour Party. They are now winning. He is going to be the Prime Minister. I mean, someone who knows him very well and has worked with him since before politics put it very wisely, I think, to me, or someone in a position to know. So I said, the thing you have to know about Keir Starmer is that whatever happens, if you're not sure and he's going up against someone in a competitive situation, just assume he's going to win. He's just ruthless, and he makes the difficult judgments, and he, in that sense, you know, you never bet against him. But that gets you there. Mm-hmm. And I think in terms of the original question, whether it's going to all unravel very quickly, certainly there is precedent for that if you look at, you know, actually Joe Biden handled the economy pretty well, but actually, you know, his popularity drifted down quite a lot. Albanese in Australia, Schultz in Germany. You know, there's a sort of a liberal centre-left person who takes over, you know, when the right has just demonstrably failed, and they sort of suddenly get it by default. They appear to struggle. And the third thing I would say, just quickly in relation to that, is there is now so much volatility in political identity, and has been, you know, it's exacerbated by Brexit, but also I think running in the run-up to that, you know, going back 10, 20 years, that actually, even if Labour get a huge number of votes, those are not Labour voters, capital L, capital V. So those, the allegiance of those people will be much more fragile and volatile than I think it would have been, you know, certainly was even in 1997 when Labour last won a landslide.
The biggest political split that's emerged to me in this conversation here is that there are actually some people who get polled who say they do want to just have pints with random strangers, because I can't think of much worse than just picking a random politician who I'd go for a drink with. Raph, when it comes to the centre-left and these sort of issues they face when they do come into power, is one of the things that, much like the Tories are good at picking out problems and then not actually solving them properly, there are quite a lot of problems at the moment which perhaps don't necessarily chime with traditional Labour values, or are more nuanced and more complex when it comes to a party with a more left-leaning outlook. And given the fact that they might actually want to solve them, which does simply require a lot more nuance than the Conservatives are giving them.
this is going to be an absolute nightmare for Labour on a number of fronts, and not least because, you know, all the caution. So at the moment, Labour's position is strengthened by the fact that the Tories are sort of unravelling. So they don't, you know, they get away with not saying very much, not owning difficult positions. So again, you know, immigration is a classic example. Like right now, the Labour Party can attack the Rwanda bill and that whole project on the grounds that it's not going to work, it's a waste of money, it's stupid. And that works. And actually, Labour are ahead of the Tories on migration as an issue for the first time pretty much ever. I mean, this is incredibly rare. All that despite not really having an immigration policy at all. Yeah. I mean, I could tell you sort of what they say, but the reality, you know, when it's next summer and Keir Starmer's prime minister and the small boats are still coming, Labour are going to have to do something about this. And they'll have a party that really, really likes to hate what the right does and says about immigration and doesn't really want to have to engage with the fact that every government forever has had to police borders, make really difficult decisions about who gets in, who doesn't, who's allowed in, on what basis, and often has to treat the people who don't get in quite harshly. And the left is not going to like that. It's not going to like reforming public services using the private sector. It's not going to like the fact that the sort of the fiscal constraints that Rachel Reeves talks about are real. She means it. And they're not going to suddenly turn on the money taps. Yeah, it's going to be really hard.
John, there's this elephant in the room that's Brexit throughout all of British politics. Starmer has said that he won't go for the youth mobility scheme plan with the EU. Well, there's no plans around it. He hasn't completely ruled it out, but said it's not within their plans. If the Commission offers that olive branch, is it not also equally politically risky for him to reject that as it would be to accept it? Because there are plenty of people in the Labour Party who will vote for him who maybe would say that sounds like an obviously good thing.
I mean, we've been having a go at Sunak for doing everything for headline purposes, and this is exactly the same. Like, I think probably Starmer's instincts would be to say yes to that, but he knows if he does that, he's going to face a couple of weeks of stories about how, like, he's secretly planning to cancel Brexit. And it doesn't matter how many polls there are showing that actually you could probably get majority support for cancelling Brexit at this point. And also, it would go a long way to dealing with the small boats crisis because it moves the border back to the Mediterranean again.
Yeah,
he's not going to do anything to suggest plans in that direction before the election. Once it's won, I don't actually think we know what he's going to do.
Totally agree. Because he's very, very likely to get into some negotiation about an agreement, but why do it now?
Exactly. I mean, I think like he will have the political space to do that, right? Because like at the moment, even now, people still on some level think you have to respect the Leave coalition. If Labour win a decent majority with a totally different coalition of voters, so that does create political space. That doesn't mean he's going to use it.
Up to a point, because actually you still have to tend that coalition, but as a defensive marginal Labour seat, as opposed to a Tory seat that you're trying to win back. So actually a lot of the sort of demographic electoral pressures that are making them cautious on this stuff now will still pertain after the election.
Yes. I mean, obviously it does completely come down to the size of the majority as well. I think in like a very small majority based on red wall seats, then yeah, nothing is going to change. He's going to be cautious. And I think, oddly enough, if there's a really big majority, I think at that point there's a chance they're going to start panicking about losing any seat, weirdly enough. So I think there is probably a sweet spot of around sort of 80 to 100 seats, but who knows?
Hannah, are there many quick wins out there? We're sort of talking about the bleak state of affairs that is there, but is there anything that he could come in and
win? Yeah, I think there's loads.
Quickly.
And also, I, you know, as the general optimist that then always gets, you know, called out when it all fucks up further down the line, I'm going to carry on taking that role. I think it's okay. I think there are a few things that they're not cheap, but there is enough money there to get done, and they'll have an immediate impact on people's day-to-day lives. So dentists is one of them. If you sort out access to dentistry, that makes an immediate difference to children, families. Like straight away, people are going to feel like something's changing. And in terms of how much you're spending on the NHS, that's actually a really small pot of money comparatively, and it's totally worth doing. Funding local government sufficiently that it can fix things like potholes, curbside recycling so that it's sensible and uniform and everybody's recycling the same stuff in a way that they can engage with. That social care is like the world's biggest question and that's very complicated. But if you're funding local government, you can start to address the social care problem. And rural public transport is another one there. Then that's all to do with the the complete lack of a proper funding structure for local government over the last 14 years. So if you've sort that out, the impact, it won't be on like the big picture immigration policy, but it will be on how people feel just going around their neighbourhoods and living their lives. And that's the kind of thing that does foster this sort of sense of like things are getting slightly better, you know, personal optimism. Family policy, obviously I'm going to bang on about this because I always do, but if you sort out things like in slightly increasing basic maternity pay, proper flexible working packages that from government that support like SMEs and so on, so that everybody has an equal chance at sharing parenting, that's the kind of thing that impacts on people's personal lives as well, along with the nursery funding that we already talked about. I think that there is actually another quick win, which is millennials who are living in a state of precarity. So there was a really interesting report last week. I've now forgotten the think tank. It came out of Lancaster University, a think tank that works at Lancaster Uni. And it found that there are 1.4 million people who are in private rent who are also in chronically insecure work. So short-term contracts, day rates, gig economy, that kind of thing. They are living really unstable lives. And if you are able to do something about that small group of people, you potentially bank a generation of Labour voters there. Because these are people who have no relationship with the Tories. They feel that their early lives have been really blighted by Tory policy. And if you sort that out for that small group of people, I think that's it could be a massive win. You know, it's not, none of it's cheap. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's complicated financially where you take the money from.
I'm aware the obviously overarching question of this section has been asked by me, but to reject the premise slightly once again, my own premise here, on the question of any politician being popular, is that something that we take for granted, which is actually a luxury to have, to actually look at any politician and consider whether you like them or not, that you care about that, when maybe actually when they're asking these questions of do you like Starmer or do you like Sunak, people are just thinking, well, I don't really like how my life is going at the moment. So there's not many people within this who I will find popular.
I don't think people, I think most people, and I don't mean this in any kind of patronising way, people have got busy lives. I think that if things do start to improve, yeah, then maybe they won't be like, oh, brilliant, this is all Keir Starmer or the Labour government and I'm really excited about it. They're much more likely to place the value on their local council improving or local businesses serving them better or maybe their union or something for having changed how their life feels. But that's okay. That's okay. Yeah. I don't think, has anybody ever really had that level of connection with the government?
I think particular, something particular about British political culture as well that puts a very high premium on the party or leader that takes politics out of your life in a really sort of subtle but very profound way. And I think one of the great triumphs of Thatcher and Thatcherism. I mean, the Conservatives think it was about winning the argument and being ideologically very successful, but actually a large part of it was just the way, certainly in the South, in the Tory heartlands, places where the Thatcherism got really bedded in, it just, being Tory was just a less political choice than being Labour. Being Labour was sort of, you know, you had to, you took up evenings, he was activist, he was busy. Whereas you could just be Tory just by, without really having to do very much. Yeah. And actually the genius of Blairism when it worked was it flipped that first time ever, really. It just, everyone was a bit New Labour in a way that it wasn't really a point of identity. You didn't have to wear the badge or turn up to the meeting. It was just, that was just a normal thing to do. And being Tory was a bit kind of egg yolk down the tie, you know, blue blazer, gold buttons, ranting about Europe. Weird, cranky.
I think you can make this argument about the success of the slogan "Get Brexit Done" as well.
Absolutely,
it wasn't just a pro-Brexit slogan; it was a "Make It Go Away" slogan.
Yeah. And I think actually, Keir Starmer could be quite effective at saying, you know, the proposition is you don't have to like me, but you know what? You can get on with the rest of your life and we'll take care of the politics and you just, you know, we'll help
you. I completely agree. And all of those, making all the things work better so that your life just operates on a level where you're not thinking about how the government's fucking up daily is definitely going to win a second term. It's just whether they can do it or not.
We've reached the end of the show, so it's time for Escape Routes. What has been distracting us from politics over the last week? John, what's been distracting you?
So last night I started watching Kenneth Clarke's Civilizations, which is this landmark documentary series from the late 60s about the history of art and Western culture and so on, which is, you know, fantastic piece of television. I have slightly done it in the wrong order. Like, I've read all the books saying its premises are wrong before I've watched the actual series. But it's all on iPlayer, so go do that.
Nice. Hannah?
Well, I got round to finally watching Scoop, the dramatisation of the former Newsnight producer Sam McAllister's memoir about securing the Prince Andrew interview for Newsnight. And it's absolutely brilliant. I met Sam once years ago when we were both working on a kind of outreach for schools in Tower Hamlets thing about getting kids into journalism. And what I loved about it is that the script, it really brought her to life. She's such a big character and you really felt that, like, you're in the room with her. And despite knowing exactly what's going to happen, because we all saw that interview, the tension in it is just fantastic. It's one of the best bits of drama I've watched in a while. There's also this brilliant line, which really stayed with me, where she's... Sam, the character of Sam, is talking to her mother in the show. And mum's trying to convince her that maybe she should resign from Newsnight because it's just like so difficult and such a tough job, screwing up her life a bit. And she's sort of crying. She says, I don't want it to be easy, mum. I just want it to matter. And I thought, you know what? That does really speak to me. And it's nice to see that kind of like pride in doing a really bloody good job. So, yeah.
And Raph, what about you?
So as a family, we have been watching Race Around the World, which is a quite trashy but very entertaining, it's not really, what would you call it? It's a game show type thing, but basically couples race each other between various destinations on the planet without the benefit of credit cards, mobile phones, communications, but with the benefit, obviously, of a production company. There are some pretty solid guardrails around their journeys, yeah. It's safe to say. And actually, I mean, the programs I could take or leave is pretty banal, but it triggered a very entertaining argument within my family. So, it's, you know, me, my wife, two daughters, about, you know, if we divided up into teams, which team would win and who would be more effective? And it's just really just spurred the kind of travel bug, and which I think every now and again, I have to be reminded that there's a world out there that I haven't seen enough of and I need to get out there as quickly as possible.
Nice. Well, mine are two horror films, one of which I want to tell people wasn't very good and one that I thought was great. So I watched a film called Swallowed over the weekend, which I'm still trying to digest what the point or purpose not deliberate actually, but you know, I still can't quite work out what it was or why I watched it. It just got so far into it that I thought I'll keep going. So I would say it's got 82% on Rotten Tomatoes and I'm not really sure why, but then I watched Smile, which was very good, about this kind of curse that occurs and spreads between different people, and its main protagonist is a therapist but then is slowly driven to insanity by this curse. And it's, yeah, really, really good. If you're into horror, which I'm quite geeky about, then I think you'll enjoy it. So that brings us to the end of the Tuesday edition of Oh God, What Now? Thank you to Hannah Fern.
Thank you.
Thank you, John Ellidge.
Thank you.
And thank you to Raph Baer.
Thank you.
Oh God, What Now? We'll be back on Thursday for our backers and Friday morning for everyone else. And our lovely supporters get a special shout out on the show too. Here are today's.
Thank you from me to Jesse Omani, David Serrato, Dipesh Patel, and Kate.
Thanks from me to Giles Wilkes, James Humphreys, Anna, and David Lang-Levitt.
And thank you from me to Angela, Sheila Bain, Jane, Chris Booten.
And finally, special hello to some of our lapsed patrons who have renewed their membership: Ron Pierce, Catherine Davies, Paul Evans, Kate Wood. I'm Jacob Jarvis. Thank you for listening to Oh God, What Now?
Oh God, What Now? Was written and presented by Jacob Jarvis, with Hannah Fern, John Ellidge, and Raphael Baer. It was produced by Chris Jones, with audio production by Robin Leburn, video production by Kieran Leslie. The designer is Jim Parrott, managing editor Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and Oh God, What Now? Is a Podmasters production.